So Tombstone is officially on the board for next month. I know. I can't help it. It's probably going to be over 3 hours long of just me yelling about mustaches.
Oh, God. God help us all.
Yeah, someone start the timer now. That episode's going to need 2 water breaks and a sandwich.
Worth it.
Hey, folks, before we dive in, just wanted to say thank you to everyone who joined us over the last couple weeks. If you missed it, we dropped 2 very special episodes. First, our Val Kilmer tribute episode, where we looked back on his legacy, his best performances, and that time he destroyed people with his eyes in Tombstone. That one meant a lot to us, and if you haven't heard it yet, go give it a listen. And then, we did Captain Ron. Yes, Captain Ron. An April Fool's special that somehow turned into a 44,000-word emotional breakdown of Martin Short, TBS programming conspiracies, and why Kurt Russell might have taken that role as a tax write-off. It was deeply unhinged and weirdly moving. So if you're new here, welcome. If you've been here, what is wrong with you? But thank you. And now, on to the show.
You're listening to Rewind or Die.
Okay, listen up. Say you're fresh out of law school, Harvard, top of your class, the world at your feet. Then, boom, some sketchy but insanely rich law firm drops a Godfather offer in your lap. More money than you've ever seen. A house, a Mercedes, paid vacations. The works. Only catch? Turns out your new bosses have a little side hustle, money laundering, for the mob. And guess what? No one quits this job, ever. You either stay forever, or you take a permanent swim in the Mississippi. This is The Firm, the John Grisham legal thriller that took over the 90s like Starbucks and Frosted Tips. Tom Cruise running like his life depends on it, because it does. Wilford Brimley is the scariest old man in suspenders. Gene Hackman just being effortlessly cool while also being the worst. And a law firm so corrupt even Enron would be like, damn, guys, tone it down. Today on Rewind or Die, we're breaking attorney-client privilege and diving deep into The Firm, the movie that made every law student reconsider their life choices. Let's get started before the FBI wiretaps my mic.
I want to start by telling you that Bendini, Lambert & Locke is a small firm, 41 lawyers and all, but I prefer to think of us as a family. And like most families, loyalty is what we value more than just about anything. Now, the letter you got from us was the only one sent out. Because you're the only one we want. We've taken your highest offer to date and added 20%, and we'll guarantee a 10% increase the second year. It may interest you to know that most of our clients are very wealthy. Poor people rarely have tax problems. It's one of the few advantages of being poor. You should also know that many of our partners are millionaires by the time they're 45. Our offer includes a bonus schedule, a low-interest mortgage for the purchase of a new home, and the lease of a new Mercedes. Your wife can choose the color. We have faith that you're going to be with us for a long, long time, Mitch. Fact is, nobody has ever left us. Nobody.
There it is again, 4 seconds of pure dad power.
That riff cost the entire budget. We had a meeting about it.
3 lawyers died to license that cymbal crash.
There was a PowerPoint.
It sounds like the intro to a court case that ends in a bar fight.
That theme is exactly what plays in Gene Hackman's head every time he walks into a room.
And every time he leaves one.
All right, let's get into Crimson Tide. It's Hackman, it's Denzel, it's nuclear standoffs and men yelling in hallways.
And maybe, just maybe, a little more theme music before we're done. All right, let's be real for a second. This isn't just about The Firm. It's about Gene Hackman, the man, the myth, the legend, and now the legend we've lost.
Yeah, we joke, but losing Gene Hackman, that one hurts. He was one of the best to ever do it. The guy didn't just act, he commanded the screen. He made every role look effortless. Like, there's a reason people still talk about The French Connection, Unforgiven, Crimson Tide. Hell, even when he was just hanging out in a thriller like The Firm, the guy was magnetic.
Dude was all killer, no filler. Even when he was playing a sleazeball, he made it look cool.
Exactly. Like, The Firm doesn't even work without Gene Hackman. He plays this perfect morally gray mentor slash dirtbag. You know he's bad news, but you like him anyway because he's Gene. Damn. Hackman. And that was his superpower. He could play anything. He could be terrifying. He could be funny. He could be the best part of a movie that didn't even deserve him.
Yeah, even when he was in some weird 90s paycheck role, you could always count on him to be great.
Man walked into Behind Enemy Lines and said, "Fine, I'll act."
But that's what makes this retrospective so important. This man retired on his own terms. He made his last movie, peaced out, and spent the rest of his life writing books and living his best damn life. And we respect that. But now that he's gone, we got to give him his flowers. We're going to cover the thrillers, the dramas, the unhinged 90s action gems, because we're sending Gene Hackman off the only way we know how.
By talking way too much about his movies.
And making it weirdly emotional.
Damn right. Gene Hackman, we salute you. Now, let's talk about how you stole The Firm right out from under Tom Cruise's running feet. All right. Before we get into yelling about Hackman again, let's actually introduce ourselves this time, because apparently we just forgot last week.
Oh, yeah, that's right. We just started talking like we were mid-conversation at a gas station.
Yeah, real professional. Nothing says high production value like three adult men yelling about faxes and never saying their names.
Okay, well, who's the producer, Steve? Aren't you the one who's supposed to keep track of this stuff?
I press record. I'm not your podcast babysitter.
You're literally the guy with the mixer.
Whatever. I'm doing it now. I'm Adam. I yell the loudest. This is Jeff. He knows actual facts and has a moral code. And that's Steve, our producer who refuses to take responsibility for anything.
Correct.
Let's go. Hackman's waiting.
Yes, we remembered to introduce ourselves this time because apparently Steve thinks forgetting is bad production value.
Because it is. We're not just shouting in an alley. This is a show.
Oh, I'm sorry, Producer Steve. Should I start announcing timestamps and sponsor breaks too? Or do you just want to edit in a foghorn every time I talk?
All right, all right. We remembered the intro. We survived the theme song somehow. So let's just get into it. The Firm. Let's do this. Okay. So I like this movie. It's a solid 90s thriller. Very dad on a lazy Saturday energy. But I gotta ask, why are we doing The Firm? Like, Adam, is there some deep personal connection you have to John Grisham movies? Did a shady law firm try to recruit you? Are you currently on the run from Wilford Brimley?
Jeff, first of all, if a shadowy corporate law firm ever tried to recruit me, I would have said yes, instantly. Do you know how much I would love a free Mercedes and a suspiciously affordable McMansion in Memphis? Second, how dare you question this pick? This is peak 90s legal thriller cinema. This movie has Tom Cruise sprinting like his 401k is on fire. It has Gene Hackman being sleazier than a fax machine in Vegas. And it has a law firm that's actually a mafia franchise. What more do you need?
I don't know. One explosion. Just one.
Yeah, something should have blown up. Even a copier. Just one fiery printer.
There's an emotional explosion, Jeff. A legal explosion. This is a thriller for adults. You gotta let it simmer. This is the kind of movie where the action scene is someone making copies in a panic. At a Kinko's.
Truly the most dangerous time of day, 4:45 p.m. at FedEx office.
Man was dodging tax charges like he was in the Bourne audit.
Yes! That's what makes it beautiful. The stakes are so high, but the threat is tax fraud. It's like if Mission Impossible was just a guy sweating over a 1099 form and being hunted by the IRS.
I mean, look, it's a good movie. I just didn't have The Firm on my Rewind or Die bingo card.
Same. We're really branching out. Next week, The Pelican Brief. Week after that, JAG reruns.
Okay. You want to know the real reason we're doing this? This is part of our Gene Hackman retrospective, baby. We are honoring the man, the legend, the grumpy old king himself. You think I'm not going to cover every major 90s Hackman flick in his memory?
Okay, that I respect.
To Gene Hackman, the only man alive who could make tax law sound like a national emergency.
Gene, we love you.
Still should have had one explosion.
We're moving on, Steve.
All right, let's break it down. Let's talk fax machines, NDAs, and how Hackman somehow makes infidelity charming.
It's time. Let's get into The Firm. Wait, okay, before we even get into the movie, I just remembered. My dad swears he took me to see The Firm in theaters.
He did not. That man took you to Die Hard 2 and walked out because the popcorn was $5.75. You were also 6.
Every single dad has one movie they think they saw in a theater, but it was actually on TBS at 2 p.m. while they were folding laundry and eating a banana.
Yes, it's dad theater syndrome. Like, son, I remember seeing The Pelican Brief opening weekend. We sat front row. No, you didn't, Bob. You fell asleep during the Golden Globes and woke up during a John Grisham marathon on basic cable.
Dads are like, your mother and I saw The Firm at the drive-in, right after Patch Adams. She cried. I got a hot dog.
My dad swore he saw Crimson Tide in theaters. We did not live near a theater.
That's movie-based memory fraud, Jeff. It's a national epidemic.
And Hackman is exactly the kind of actor who lives in false dad memories.
Gene Hackman is a VHS memory. He's not a man. He's a blockbuster shelf.
To all the fictional fathers who saw The Firm in a theater that didn't exist and yelled at the screen during the fax machine chase scene.
You know who you are.
I want popcorn now.
We haven't even started the movie yet.
You know, watching The Firm, I kept thinking, 1993 was such a weird year for movies, but also for music. Like, you had this awkward moment where grunge was still huge, but also adult contemporary was fighting for radio dominance. And then, of course, the rise of post-grunge.
Oh, post-grunge, the darkest timeline. That whole not quite Nirvana, not quite Pearl Jam thing. That's when you get Candlebox.
Adam's already mad.
Candlebox? Their 1.5 hit?
1.5?
Wait, what was the half hit?
Okay, full hit. Far Behind. Certified I Just Got Dumped and I'm Standing in the Rain jukebox classic. If you go into any dive bar with a jukebox, there is a 100% chance some guy in a faded denim jacket plays Far Behind while aggressively nodding to himself like he just filed for divorce.
I know that guy. That guy has a leather wallet with a chain.
Or he's in the background of a Pawn Stars episode.
Exactly. Now, the half hit? You. The song You. Technically got airplay. Technically had a video. But it exists in Mandela Effect limbo. Half the world remembers it. The other half thinks you made it up after falling asleep with a Slurpee in 1996. It only plays in dreams or during a VH1 classic block at 2 a.m.
Wait, was the half hit You, or was it Cover Me, or Change?
Steve, how do you know this many Candlebox songs?
Steve, do you own a Candlebox CD?
Not answering that.
There is no way anyone knows this many Candlebox songs. Even the band members don't know this many songs. If you ask the lead singer to name a third track, he'd start sweating.
You think he'd panic?
Absolutely. You'd see pure terror in his eyes. Far Behind, You, and oh God, someone Google it.
I bet the drummer just guesses and prays he's right.
Exactly. They'd be on stage and someone would yell, play Change, and they'd all look at each other like, did we write that one?
This is why they don't get more than, 1.5 hits. If the band can't pass a Candlebox trivia quiz, they don't get to claim a third song.
So what you're saying is we're doing an episode on Candlebox.
No, Steve.
Okay, fine, but just to clarify, what's the ruling on Live? Because Throwing Copper was everywhere.
Nothing exists after Throwing Copper. That's it. That's the cutoff. The Live timeline ends there.
Okay, but that's a whole different year.
Doesn't matter. Don't get into semantics, Jeff. Time stops after lightning crashes. Everything else is post-apocalyptic filler.
Bold. So, no Secret Samadhi episode?
Steve, I will walk off this show.
All right. Before Adam starts ranking Bush albums in a rage, let's get back on track. And just to clarify, when we say The Firm, we mean the movie, not the band The Firm. Because nobody is out here reminiscing about Paul Rodgers and Jimmy Page doing Radioactive in 1985.
Somebody was.
Yeah, and his name was Paul Rodgers.
So, what's the half hit for Spin Doctors?
Oh, don't even start. Spin Doctors were the acoustic equivalent of a flea market t-shirt.
Oh, this is happening.
Everyone knows Two Princes. Fine. It's catchy. It sounds like the 90s in Capri Sun form. But Little Miss Can't Be Wrong? That's the pettiest breakup song ever recorded.
Oh, yeah. That song is just I Hate My Ex, set to goofy guitar strumming.
The world is all right with me just as long as you're not in it. It's not lyrics. That's a restraining order set to a Dave Matthews riff. You know,
vicious. But still, what's their half hit?
None. They get zero half hits. After Two Princes and Little Miss, they fell into the Dave Matthews black hole and were never seen again.
All right. Let's bring it back. Before Adam starts foaming at the mouth about Better Than Ezra. All right. Look, I get it. Gene Hackman is a legend. We just spent 20 minutes yelling about it, but out of all the Hackman movies we could have started with, why this one? Not Unforgiven, not The French Connection, not Crimson Tide, which we're already doing next week. Why are we opening the Hackman retrospective with The Firm?
Because it's a masterpiece, Jeff.
Also because Adam made a spreadsheet.
You made a spreadsheet?
Yes, I did. It had Hackman intensity ratings and Cardigan threat levels. The Firm scored off the charts. This movie was a 1993 event. It was huge. Tom Cruise was at maximum sprint. Gene Hackman was morally gray and oddly seductive. It's about a law firm that is literally a mob front, and no one questions it because they give you a free BMW and a bowl of lies.
I mean, yeah, Hackman does show up late and immediately starts sweating charisma and infidelity.
He shows up like he's cheating in a board game and dares you to prove it.
That's what makes it the perfect starter Hackman for anyone who never caught The French Connection at 2 a.m. on TNT or didn't grow up being yelled at by emotionally unavailable father figures.
Wow.
That felt personal.
But seriously, you're saying this is better to start with than Crimson Tide?
Crimson Tide is the grand finale. That's Dot, Hackman versus Denzel in a nuclear yelling match inside a metal tube of consequences.
And we're saving The Replacements for last, because Adam thinks that's the movie Hackman should have retired on.
Not the Royal Tenenbaums.
That was Wes Anderson's win, not Hackman's mic drop.
So, not Welcome to Mooseport either?
That movie was a trap. A lie. Hackman deserved so much better than to end his career arguing with Ray Romano in a fictional mayoral election.
Or did you just want to talk about Wilford Brimley again?
Okay, yes. Also that, because Wilford Brimley in this movie is a nightmare in human form. He is a soft-spoken Cardigan demon, and I will not be gaslit about this.
That's what you're taking away from The Firm? Not the high-stakes thriller? Not the tense plot or Cruise running in slacks? Just Brimley the threat?
Yes, Jeff, because Wilford Brimley doesn't need a gun. He doesn't need a chase scene. He just leans in and starts quietly threatening your wife in paralegal language, and suddenly you forget how to breathe.
Cool. So we're doing Cocoon next?
No, Steve, we are not doing Cocoon next.
All right, fine. Let's break down the firm and give Gene Hackman the appreciation he deserves, while Adam continues spiraling into his Wilford Brimley cinematic universe.
Cheers to Cardigan-based intimidation.
Let's get into it. The firm, where accounting becomes warfare. All right, let's talk about something bigger. Let's talk about the John Grisham movie phenomenon. Because for a solid decade, Hollywood was obsessed with turning this dude's books into thrillers for adults. You were legally required to see at least one Grisham movie every year in the 90s. They were everywhere.
Oh, yeah. If it had John Grisham on the cover, it was getting a star-studded movie adaptation. No questions asked.
Yeah, every dad in America was reading these on a beach somewhere, had the same paperback copy, creased spine, sand in the pages.
Exactly. Grisham movies were like Dad's Cinematic Universe Phase 1. Every single one was like, what if a young, idealistic lawyer uncovered something he wasn't supposed to, and now he's in over his head? And boom, that was a $100 million movie.
The Firm, The Pelican Brief, The Client, A Time to Kill, The Rainmaker.
Christmas with the Cranks.
Steve, I swear to God.
But yeah, the 90s were a golden age for the Grisham thriller. They all had that prestige thriller energy. Big stars, dramatic courtrooms, villains in expensive suits. And they made being a lawyer look like the most dangerous job on earth.
Yes. In a Grisham movie, being a lawyer was somehow more deadly than being a cop. You didn't just file motions. You got car chases. You got assassins. You got secret files that could get you killed. Like, being a lawyer in one of these movies was as dangerous as being in the CIA.
Imagine going to law school and thinking your life's gonna be like The Firm. Then you just end up doing zoning permits for 40 years.
Devastating.
Why am I not being chased through an underground parking garage right now?
This is why people started going to law school in the 90s. They thought they were signing up for espionage.
And instead, they got student loans and 12-hour depositions. But for a brief, shining moment, John Grisham had America believing that lawyers were action heroes. And that is why we're kicking off our Gene Hackman retrospective with The Firm, because this movie was at the peak of the Grisham Hollywood takeover.
So we are doing The Pelican Brief next.
No, Steve.
All right, let's get into it. How The Firm became the biggest Grisham adaptation. Why Gene Hackman owned every scene. And yes, Adam, we'll talk more about Wilford Brimley. Let's cue into the film breakdown. Are we back?
Hang on. Oh, wait. Okay, now we're back.
Great. Hopefully we edit this out.
Edit? We edit nothing. This podcast is raw. It's live energy. It's truth. It's you fumbling with the record button for 40 seconds and me eating trail mix into the mic.
Perfect. Can't wait to relive that in Dolby Surround.
You ever hear people call John Grisham books beach reads? I never got that. Who's out on a beach getting some sun, listening to the waves and thinking, man, I wish I was in a high-stakes legal thriller right now.
Some people just want to imagine themselves in a law office while their feet are in the sand.
I guess that's better than imagining yourself in a law office while you're actually in a law office.
See, I think beach reads should be fun. Like, if you're at the beach, you don't want to be thinking about corrupt law firms and offshore bank accounts. You want something that matches the vibe. That's why I'm pitching a new genre, Jimmy Buffett Mysteries.
Oh, no.
You've thought about this before, haven't you?
Picture it. Margaritaville murders. A washed-up PI in Key West solves crimes between rum runners and shady dock deals. His partner? A laid-back parrot who might be psychic, but mostly just insults him. Every book title, a Buffett song.
A lawyer and a lost shaker of salt.
Cheeseburgers and alibices.
Fins to the left, suspects to the right.
I hate how good these are.
Come Monday, somebody's dead.
Boom. Beach read perfection.
The estate of Jimmy Buffett is sending you a cease and desist as we speak.
I mean, it makes more sense than sitting on a beach fantasizing about depositions.
Exactly! If I'm reading at the beach, I want dangerous smugglers, stolen treasure, a boat chase, not Can the jury be sequestered, Your Honor?
I feel like this is just you making an argument to do an episode on Fool's Gold.
Yeah, he's definitely angling for it.
Listen, all I'm saying is the firm would be better if Tom Cruise was solving murders in a Hawaiian shirt with a coconut drink in his hand.
And Gene Hackman?
He'd still be in a suit.
He's Gene Hackman. Of course he would.
Adam, I hate to break it to you, but you're basically just describing Carl Hiaasen novels.
Wait, what?
Yeah, dude, he's been writing these Florida crime capers forever. Corrupt developers, weird criminals, wacky hijinks, environmental revenge schemes, it's all there.
And he never wrote Jimmy Buffett mysteries?
Not officially. But his books are pretty much what you're talking about.
If a parrot with a drinking problem showed up, I wouldn't be surprised.
Damn. I thought I had something there.
You were this close to reinventing the wheel.
The wheel, but with more piña coladas.
Okay, fine. Margaritaville Murders is dead. But what if we pivot? A Tommy Bahama noir series.
Adam, stop.
No, let him cook.
Imagine it. The Panama Hat Conspiracy. A private eye investigates the mysterious disappearance of a boat salesman while juggling an ill-advised affair with a lounge singer at a Jimmy Buffett's Margaritaville restaurant.
Okay, that one kind of works.
I'd read that.
See? That's a real beach read. Not, can the SEC prosecute my employer for fraud?
I mean, I'm still reading The Firm if I'm picking between the two.
And I'm reading Cheeseburgers and Alibi Says.
That's why you're the only one here with taste, Steve. But anyway, back to Jimmy Buffett mysteries, because I refuse to let this dream die.
Oh, God.
He's locked in. We've lost him.
Picture this, License to Chill, a murder in Margaritaville. Our hero, a washed-up ex-detective turned boat charter captain who stumbles onto a dead body in the freezer of a tiki bar. The only clue, a missing shaker of salt.
Stop.
Go on.
He's got to solve the case while dealing with a corrupt cruise line, an ex-wife who now runs a rival boat tour business, and a hitman known only as the Parrot Head.
This is just Fletch in flip-flops.
And it's better than The Firm. Tom Cruise could have been doing this instead of running away from Wilford Brimley in a law office.
So, instead of Mitch McDeer discovers his law firm is corrupt, you want Captain Jack Mojito investigates a series of mysterious boat disappearances while dodging the Coast Guard and trying to make it to a sunset gig at Margaritaville.
Yes!
Honestly, I'd greenlight that.
I hate this, but also, I respect it.
Thank you. Now, do I need to copyright this right now, or...
The Buffett estate is still listening.
Yeah. The second you say Margaritaville, they materialize like a ghost ship.
Fine. Then we call it Rum-Soaked Retribution, a Key West mystery.
You know what? Screw it. Let's get Gene Hackman in it, too. I mean, if he wasn't dead, of course.
Hell yes. Don't care. It's Hackman as a retired CIA agent turned beach bum who gets dragged back in for one last case.
I thought I was done with this life, but then someone poisoned my Mai Tai.
Now, Dot, they're going to wish they'd stayed on the boat.
This is the dumbest conversation we've ever had.
Which is saying something.
And yet, you'd watch it.
Yeah.
The Margaritaville murders will return.
Oh, my God.
Like a rogue wave, you never see it coming.
And when it does, there'll be rum, there'll be sun. And there'll be mystery.
I hate that I know this is going to come back again.
Oh, yeah. He's already thinking about a sequel.
A whole series. Okay, but I'm just saying, if three guys in Hawaiian shirts mysteriously die on vacation within the same company and nobody asks questions, that's not just suspicious. That's a tropical red flag factory.
They should have called the sequel The Firm, too. Death in the Keys.
Starring Tom Cruise and Jimmy Buffett as the private investigator.
This summer, he's trading spreadsheets for SPF 100, and the case just got sandy.
Murder on the beach, with cocktails.
Okay. Let's put down the frozen margarita. We've had enough Jimmy Buffett-based conspiracy theories for now. Let's get back into the movie before Adam starts plotting a spinoff about Brimley opening a tiki bar.
Which would be incredible.
I'd watch 6 seasons of that.
No, we're moving on. Back to the firm, where tax fraud is deadly and every meeting ends in mild intimidation.
You know what? If Brimley had survived the movie, I feel like he would have retired to the islands and opened a tiki bar.
Nope. No, absolutely not. We are not doing a Wilford Brimley tiki bar bit.
Too late. I'd buy into that. I'm picturing like dark wood, looming silence, and drinks with names like The Quiet Threat.
Yes, welcome to Wilford Brimley's Island Threat. Every cocktail comes with a stern lecture and a mild sense of dread.
Guys, come on. We just got back on track. This is not canon.
No, this is absolutely canon. The bar has no music, just the sound of fax machines and rustling manila folders.
Try the Moral Gray Mojito, now with 50% more plausible deniability.
God help me. Fine. 2 minutes of this, and then we're actually talking about the movie.
Tiki Threat Tuesdays. Every fourth drink comes with a sealed envelope and a warning.
And if you ask what's in the diabetic sunrise, you're escorted out. Quietly, but permanently.
I hate how quickly you two built the lore.
Welcome to Paradise, Brimley style.
No more. Back to the firm. Now, before someone draws up a Brimley franchise pitch deck.
You know what I've been wondering since watching The Firm again? Who is the guy who designs those weird corporate welcome packets? Like, who sits down and thinks, let's give this new employee a BMW, a 3-bedroom house, and a binder of vague evil promises?
Right? It's like HR meets The Godfather. Welcome to the team. Also, don't talk to the FBI. Ever.
And no one reads the fine print. It's just like, cool house. Where's the murder clause?
Page 37, right under client confidentiality and ocean-based body disposal.
Honestly, the real horror in this movie is signing a 25-page contract without a lawyer.
Or trusting anything in a folder handed to you by Wilford Brimley.
God-tier onboarding villain.
Okay, let's take a break before this turns into a Brimley HR conspiracy.
Too late, we're already in the folder.
The folder was inside us all along. Oh.
Today's episode of Rewind or Die is brought to you by WelcomeWorks, the world's most aggressive onboarding solution. When your job needs loyalty and can't risk questions, WelcomeWorks is there. At WelcomeWorks, we believe every new hire deserves a new house, a luxury car, and lifetime confidentiality, whether they want it or not. Ask your HR rep about our family relocation package trademark. All it takes is one signature, on one form, in triplicate, with witnesses, preferably none. Side effects may include unexplained surveillance, envelope-related stress, and Wilford Brimley standing just behind you forever. WelcomeWorks, your job is your life now. Don't ask questions, don't make waves, and whatever you do, don't talk to the FBI, humpai.
Huge thanks to Lewis for reading that ad with exactly the right amount of authority and fear.
Legitimately felt like I signed something just by hearing that.
Seriously, thank you, Lewis. And as promised, you get one movie pick. What are we covering?
Blankman.
I'm sorry, what?
Blankman, like Damon Wayans' homemade superhero suit.
Y'all said any movie. I stand by Blankman. It's visionary.
Nope. I'm in. I'm fully in. Blankman is officially going on the schedule.
Fine, but I'm not doing Meteor Man. That's where I draw the line.
All right, let's get back to Act One of The Firm. Before Mitch signs anything else, and Brimley shows up with a folder and a warning.
All right. So, how do we even start talking about the plot of The Firm? Because, like, is there a plot? Or is it just vibes, paperwork, and people sweating in conference rooms?
It's a mood thriller, a spreadsheet noir. The only film where the big reveal is an accounting loophole.
The plot is, what if your job interview was secretly a mob audition?
Yes, it starts normal. Fresh-faced Harvard grad, big offer, free car. And then within 15 minutes, it's like, hey, Mitch, do you love confidentiality, hate asking questions, and enjoy suspicious dental plans?
Welcome to The Firm. We have a gym, a free BMW, and an extensive history of body disposal.
Oh, and the last guy who quit, yeah, he's dead. But hey, how do you feel about tax shelters in the Cayman Islands?
And half the plot is just Tom Cruise reacting to things like paperwork, more paperwork, a fax, a man in a linen shirt mysteriously drowning, and Gene Hackman being charming and morally bankrupt.
This movie is 2 hours and 34 minutes of legal anxiety and so many documents. There are literal montages of copy machines and signature sheets.
And somehow, it slaps.
It's a thriller where the action scenes involve Mitch looking increasingly alarmed at folders.
The climax of the movie is Tom Cruise writing on a legal pad really intensely.
And mailing things, there is a suspense sequence built around certified mail.
Okay, but it works? Like, I was tense. He opens a drawer and I'm like, oh no. He picks up a pen and I'm like, it's happening.
I've never been so invested in manila envelopes. This movie made me sweat during a file sort.
This is adult thriller. The movie. If John Wick is, you hurt my dog, then The Firm is, you messed with my mortgage.
Honestly? Perfect. This is high-stakes homeowners association cinema.
Yeah, so how do we describe the plot? You don't. You feel it. Like a tense memo you got CC'd on at work, but don't understand.
It's not a plot. It's an HR violation with music.
Act 1. Welcome to the mob. Here's a BMW. You're going to make a lot of money, but also maybe die.
Okay. Let's set the stage. It's the early 90s. The hair is floppy. The suits are boxy. And a young Tom Cruise is out here playing Mitch McDeer. A Harvard Law graduate with a six-pack and absolutely no instinct for danger.
He's got that I worked my way up from nothing backstory, right? Like, this guy was eating ramen in a janitor's closet last year, and now he's getting courted by every top law firm in the country.
And he chooses Memphis.
New York? D.C.? Nah, bro. I'm taking my talents to Memphis. Nothing suspicious about that at all.
So this firm rolls up like the devil's HR department. They're like, hey, Mitch, you want a free house, a BMW, lifetime dental? Here's a contract written in human blood.
And Mitch just eats it up. He's like, wow, these guys are so generous. Meanwhile, they're already measuring him for a cement suit.
I love how they immediately start grooming him like he's being inducted into a white-collar cult. Like, day one, they're assigning him a mentor, grilling him about his family, and pushing him to have kids ASAP. Like, what is this, a firm or a fertility farm?
Yes! They're like, our lawyers are happiest when they have young children, quiet wives, and no outside hobbies or friends. That's not a job, that's a lifestyle trap.
Oh, and then they give him this big, fancy house and say, surprise, it's already furnished. You don't even have to move in. Just surrender your free will.
They give him a house like a sinister HGTV show. Welcome to Fixer Upper Organized Crime Edition. We upgraded the kitchen and installed surveillance in every room.
And the house has a panic button, not for him to call the cops, for the firm to track him. That's not a security system. That's a paranoia package.
And Mitch is walking around like, wow, Abby, can you believe how nice everyone is?
Yes, Mitch, that's because they're watching you. You're already in too deep and you haven't even had orientation yet.
Meanwhile, Abby's already side-eyeing everything. She steps into the house and immediately gets we're going to die here vibes.
And she's right. There are dead lawyers in this firm's past and nobody blinks. They're like, oh yeah, two of our associates died in a boating accident last month. But don't worry, that's just our version of HR turnover.
It's presented so casually, like, here's your employee handbook, here's your ID badge, here's a gentle reminder that death by boat is part of the benefits package.
Now remember, we're a family here, a family that occasionally loses members mysteriously in open water.
Bro, two guys die, and the firm's like, welp, back to lunch. That is not normal behavior.
You'll find we really value loyalty. And if you're disloyal, you may find yourself adrift, metaphorically and also literally.
They say boating accident like it's a totally common HR exit strategy. What's next? Drownings in the break room? Oh, Jim slipped into the espresso machine. Tragic.
And Mitch is still like, gee whiz, what a great opportunity. Sir, please, your coworkers are dying, your house is haunted, and Wilford Brimley is watching your mail.
And your soul.
So that's Act One, the setup, the seduction, the BMW-fueled trip straight into hell disguised as a law firm.
Exactly. The moral of this act? If it looks too good to be true, and there's a cardiganed man silently staring at you, run.
But instead, Mitch takes the car, signs the contract, and sets himself up for 1,000% more anxiety than any human man should legally endure.
A-D-A-M.
Grinning. Mob by accident.
All right, so Mitch is officially in. He's got the car, the house, the corner office. And within like 12 seconds of starting, things go from, wow, what a great job, to, oh no, I'm definitely in a cult.
Huh, my phone's acting weird. Yeah, Mitch, that's because it's wired. To hell. You think that clicking sound is a coincidence? Welcome to the surveillance state, baby.
Meanwhile, the firm is gifting him a briefcase with a GPS tracker, a phone with one button, and an unspoken rule that you never take files home or ask questions unless you want to end up in a coffin full of toner ink.
Oh, wow, you guys really care about confidentiality. No, Mitch, they care about control. You're not a lawyer anymore. You're a legally binding hostage.
And the pressure? Immediate. They've got him working 20-hour days, billing like 500 fake hours a week, and attending mandatory client dinner parties with people who may or may not be armed.
They're not co-workers. They're mob interns.
Ha ha ha! Yes. These dudes are out here in matching suits, sipping red wine, casually discussing estate planning and contract killings like it's the same task.
And let's talk about Avery Toler. That's Gene Hackman's character, a.k.a. the smoothest piece of human trash on two legs.
Gene Hackman shows up in a light linen suit, drinking at 10 a.m., and immediately goes, hey, Mitch, let me show you how to cheat on your wife and launder mob money with style.
Honestly, I would have joined the mob, too. Hackman makes it sound fun.
He's like a morally bankrupt TED Talk. Step one, be charming. Step two, drink scotch in daylight. Step three, betray everyone you know.
And what's insane is that he's likable. You know he's shady. You know he's hiding dead bodies under his floorboards. And you're still like, yeah, I'd probably get brunch with this man.
Meanwhile, Abby, Mitch's wife, is standing off to the side like a character from the Stepford Wives who've seen some shit. Asking where you're sick.
Hey, honey, why do all your coworkers look like they're in witness protection? Why are there no women in this firm? Why is that one guy crying into his shrimp cocktail?
And she knows. She knows from the second they move in that something is wrong.
She's in the background of every scene like, this man is either going to get promoted or assassinated, and probably both.
And while she's spiraling quietly, Mitch is still like, wow. The firm sure is generous. I've got health insurance, a country club membership, and three men following me to work every day.
This dude is constantly being tailed and just shrugs it off like it's standard onboarding.
Bro's acting like being stalked is part of the benefits package.
And then, the accidents start piling up. The suicides, the accidental deaths, and every time someone dies, the firm sends flowers and a legal NDA.
It's honestly impressive how casual they are about homicide. Like, oh yeah, we lost another associate last week. That's why we built the patio.
Mitch, you are in danger. When your firm has more dead lawyers than live ones, that's a red flag.
By this point, Mitch is sweating constantly. He looks like he's on day four of a meth detox, but is still like, wow, what a great career opportunity.
He's got a BMW and a death wish.
And this, friends, is the American dream. Rise from poverty. Crush Harvard. sell your soul for $96,000 a year and a suspicious amount of file cabinets.
So, to summarize Act Two, Mitch is in too deep. Abby is ready to burn the house down. Hackman is sipping cocktails on a yacht made of lies. And Brimley?
Brimley is watching.
Always watching.
And that's Act Two, baby.
Okay, Mitch, listen, we know the firm's dirty. We know you know. And we'd like to offer you a fun little ultimatum. Help us or go to prison forever.
Yes, the FBI shows up out of nowhere. One second, Mitch is enjoying a suspiciously nice steak dinner. The next, boom, Ed Harris is in a trench coat talking like he hasn't felt joy since the Nixon administration.
He looks like he sleeps standing up in a storage unit behind a Waffle House.
Ed Harris is giving off pure bad divorce energy. He's not even trying to comfort Mitch. He's just like, you're in the mob now, congrats. You're going to die unless you play this perfectly. Also, we don't care about you.
But I'm just a lawyer. Too late, baby. You're a key witness in a RICO investigation now. Enjoy your new life of panic attacks and windowless rooms.
They tell him flat out, the Morolto crime family owns your firm. You're laundering mob money. You're complicit. Your only way out is to snitch with style.
And Mitch, sweat levels now critical, is trying to balance it all. He's like, okay, so I'll secretly work with the FBI without letting the firm or the mob know, while also saving my marriage and keeping my job?
Bro, get a hobby.
So now we're watching Mitch lie to everyone. His bosses, the FBI, his wife, the guy at the coffee cart. Mitch is juggling death.
And the firm starts tightening the screws. They're watching him more. Brimley is just lurking in the halls like a cardigan-wrapped Dementor.
He's like a human screensaver. You turn your back and he's suddenly closer.
I swear he teleports. He's in every hallway, behind every filing cabinet, just breathing like a haunted humidifier.
It's like Mitch is trapped in a corporate escape room, and the boss fight is Wilford Brimley in a sweater vest.
Okay, let's talk about Holly freaking Hunter.
She plays the secretary of a dead PI and shows up with, like, 4 minutes of screen time and steals the movie.
She's got southern sass and access to stolen documents. It's beautiful.
She talks faster than legally allowed and helps Mitch set up the print room sting operation. She's out here pickpocketing the mafia while wearing a windbreaker from JCPenney.
And you instantly believe she could kill a man with a paperclip and then balance the books.
So the FBI wants evidence. The firm is on to him. Brimley's breathing is getting louder. And Mitch goes, I'm going to make secret copies of every mob file I can get my hands on.
With what? A gun? A spy camera? Nope. A Xerox machine.
And now we enter the copy room of destiny, a.k.a.
The print room of doom.
And while all this is happening, Abby is out here going, hey, remember when we were going to have a life together?
Remember brunch? Remember trust?
She has no idea that her husband is now a triple agent with a stress rash.
And once she finds out, she's done. She packs her bags. She moves out. She says, I married a lawyer, not Jason Bourne in Dockers.
And it hurts because she's right. Mitch has become a legal ninja hiding flash drives in cereal boxes and lying to everyone with cruise eyes.
Mitch is now in survival mode. Everyone's watching him. The FBI is impatient. The firm is suspicious. His wife is gone. And he's just trying to not die before lunch.
Honestly, it's the most stressful work week since Office Space.
This act ends with one undeniable truth. Everyone wants a piece of Mitch. The mob wants him dead. The FBI wants him to flip. The firm wants him loyal. And his wife just wants him to stop sweating on the kitchen floor.
So, what does Mitch do next?
He gets weird with the IRS, baby. But that's for Act Four.
Coming up next, Cruise, Sweat, Schemes, and Redemption Through Accounting.
Let's go!
Everything is falling apart. The firm is imploding. The FBI is furious. The mob is exposed, and through all of it, Mitch McDear, our sweat-drenched Xerox-powered protagonist, somehow survives.
He did it. This man single-handedly destroyed a criminal empire with nothing but paperclips and integrity.
Justice was served, stapled, and collated.
But let's talk about the real magic trick in this finale. Not the FBI, not the mob takedown. No, no, no. Let's talk about Gene. Damn. Hackman.
Hackman! This man, this legend, doesn't get caught, doesn't die, doesn't even flinch. He just vanishes.
He walks out of this movie like he knew it was a simulation.
The firm is burning. Mitch is flipping the feds. Everyone is going to jail or getting shot or disappearing mysteriously. And Hackman.
I'll be on a beach somewhere, drinking something with a citrus wedge, wondering how the hell I got away with all of this. Again, yes.
You could tell me there's a spin-off movie where Avery Toller becomes a wine smuggler in Portugal, and I'd believe it.
He doesn't get justice. He doesn't get closure. He just gets to leave.
And honestly, he earned it. Hackman carried this movie on his back in flip-flops and a silk shirt. He was morally bankrupt, charming as hell, and always sipping something.
And Mitch? Mitch walks away clean. No charges, no bullets, just a 1,000-yard stare and a newfound respect for tax law.
He and Abby go back to Boston and open a mom-and-pop legal clinic that definitely has zero mob ties and a heavy-duty shredder.
And the final shot? Mitch just walking away. No car chase, no explosion, just peace. Because for the first time in the whole movie, no one is watching him.
Not the FBI, not the mob, not even Wilford Brimley. R.I.P. Oatmeal God.
His mustache lives on in the wind.
This movie rules. It's 2.5 hours of sweaty paranoia, copy machine espionage, and Hackman being the most, and it holds up. It's tightly written, weirdly sexy, and shockingly tense for a movie about contracts.
It's also peak Cruise. You want to watch a guy lie, run, and nearly die while holding a manila folder? This is the one.
You want a thriller where the final boss is a billing error? Boom. The Firm.
And on a real note, this was the perfect movie to kick off our Gene Hackman retrospective, because this is the sweet spot. Morally gray, totally magnetic, classy chaos.
Rest in peace, Gene. You made sweaty thrillers into Oscar-tier cuisine.
And you made being evil look so damn smooth that I'm not even sure it's evil.
Okay, so Mitch is cornered. He's out of options. The mob wants him dead. The firm is watching him like a hawk. The FBI is breathing down his neck, and his wife just peaced out with their golden retriever and all their dignity.
And this is the moment. This is when Mitch McDear becomes a legal action hero.
AKA, the only man in film history who wins a final showdown with no gun, no backup, no plan, just a deep understanding of client billing practices.
Here's what he does. He finds the one weakness in this bulletproof criminal enterprise. Not the guns, not the hitmen, not the bribes. No, it's the overbilling.
Yes. He takes them down with inflated timesheets. Oh, hey, I noticed you charged 23 hours. For reviewing a one-page contract? That's a felony.
Turns out white-collar crime has a paper trail, and Mitch Xeroxed it.
It's genius. He realizes that if he rats out the mob, he violates attorney-client privilege and goes to prison. But if he reports fraudulent billing practices to the IRS, that's a legal slam dunk.
And the best part? The firm can't fight back. Because to deny it, they'd have to admit to laundering money for the mafia. It's checkmate via QuickBooks. Meanwhile, back at the paranoia factory.
The firm is suspicious. Brimley's eyes are narrowed. People are whispering. The thermostat's at 65, but everyone's sweating like it's Saigon.
Mitch is doing full-blown spycraft now, swapping tapes, moving files, dodging Brimley like he's playing Metal Gear Solid. Law school edition.
He's ducking behind cubicles, sending coded messages via fax, sneaking around like Jason Bourne if he went to Yale.
He's got the entire firm on high alert, and they still can't stop him because he's just a really fast dude with really accurate time entries.
And then our girl Abby comes back. Mitch explains the whole plan, and instead of punching him in the face or filing for divorce, she says, "Let's do this."
It's beautiful. A romantic reconciliation powered by white-collar espionage. She literally helps him run the final phase of the plan while pretending to still hate him.
She's pulling fake smiles, swapping envelopes, acting like she's just visiting the office when really she's committing federal crimes for love.
It's a heist romance courtroom thriller, and somehow it works.
So, Mitch finally makes the drop. He hands over boxes of evidence, not to the FBI, not to the mob, but to the U.S. Attorney Office.
And that's the masterstroke. He doesn't just flip. He goes nuclear.
And what's their evidence? Thousands of pages of fraudulent billing. An entire forest died so Mitch could stick it to the mafia.
He's out here fighting organized crime with a three-hole punch and a stack of itemized invoices.
And the feds? They eat it up. It's all legal. It's all clean. And the firm can't touch him without admitting they're literally run by Tony Soprano.
And Brimley?
Vanishes into the night. Possibly exploded. No one knows. No body. Just dust and rage.
Mitch and Abby leave Memphis. No more mob. No more FBI. Just them. Walking off together, in love again. Ready to rebuild their life without, you know, RICO charges.
Roll credits.
He did it. He defeated the mafia with tax law. To recap, what did we learn?
1. Never trust a law firm that gives you a free BMW.
2. Wilford Brimley should never be allowed near a fax machine.
3. If your boss says, "We're a family here," run.
4. You can bring down organized crime with a spreadsheet and a dream. Everything is falling apart. The firm is imploding. The FBI is furious. The mob is exposed. And through all of it, Mitch McDear, our sweat-drenched, Xerox-powered protagonist, somehow survives.
He did it. This man single-handedly destroyed a criminal empire with nothing but paperclips and integrity.
Justice was served, stapled, and collated.
But let's talk about the real magic trick in this finale. Not the FBI, not the mob takedown. No, no, no. Let's talk about Gene. Damn. Hackman.
Hackman! This man, this legend, doesn't get caught, doesn't die, doesn't even flinch. He just vanishes.
He walks out of this movie like he knew it was a simulation.
The firm is burning. Mitch is flipping the feds. Everyone is going to jail or getting shot or disappearing mysteriously. And Hackman.
I'll be on a beach somewhere, drinking something with a citrus wedge, wondering how the hell I got away with all of this. Again, yes.
You could tell me there's a spin-off movie where Avery Toller becomes a wine smuggler in Portugal, and I'd believe it.
He doesn't get justice. He doesn't get closure. He just gets to leave.
And honestly, he earned it. Hackman carried this movie on his back in flip-flops and a silk shirt. He was morally bankrupt, charming as hell, and always sipping something.
And Mitch? Mitch walks away clean. No charges, no bullets, just a 1,000-yard stare and a newfound respect for tax law.
He and Abby go back to Boston and open a mom-and-pop legal clinic that definitely has zero mob ties and a heavy-duty shredder.
And the final shot? Mitch just walking away, no car chase, no explosion, just peace. Because for the first time in the whole movie, no one is watching him.
Not the FBI, not the mob, not even Wilford Brimley. R.I.P. Oatmeal God.
His mustache lives on in the wind.
This movie rules. It's 2.5 hours of sweaty paranoia, copy machine espionage, and Hackman being the most, and it holds up. It's tightly written. Weirdly sexy and shockingly tense for a movie about contracts.
It's also peak Cruise. You want to watch a guy lie, run, and nearly die while holding a manila folder? This is the one.
You want a thriller where the final boss is a billing error? Boom. The Firm.
And on a real note, this was the perfect movie to kick off our Gene Hackman retrospective, because this is the sweet spot. Morally gray, totally magnetic, classy chaos.
Rest in peace, Gene. You made sweaty thrillers into Oscar-tier cuisine.
And you made being evil look so damn smooth that I'm not even sure it's evil.
Okay, so that was the plot. That was The Firm. We just described a movie where Tom Cruise fights the mob with legal ethics. And somehow it works?
It works because everyone is sweating professionally. Cruise is sweating. Hackman is sweating. Brimley is sweating pure evil. That's what makes it cinema.
I've never seen so many important documents exchanged in high humidity.
But if you really break it down, this plot is insane. The Firm is clearly a front for organized crime. Like, there are murders, people are disappearing, there are photocopier stakeouts. And Mitch is just like, huh, bit of a learning curve.
Oh no, another coworker fell into the river and never came back up. Anyway, back to client acquisition.
That firm has so many dead employees, they should have a commemorative bench. But
let's talk about Gene Hackman. Because I love this performance, but also, what was his deal?
He's too cool to be this corrupt. He's like, I'm laundering money, cheating on my wife, and mentoring the young guy I might have to kill. But hey, let's grab sushi.
He's basically playing Tony Soprano in a Tommy Bahama shirt.
What makes it work is that he's likable. You like him, even when he's doing horrible stuff. When he's giving Cruz that speech about compromise, I was like, yeah, that tracks. I'd take the bribe, too.
He's a walking ethical crisis, and he delivers every line like he's just a little buzzed. It's perfect. He's not evil. He's tired. He's over it. He's like, kid, I tried to be good. I lost. Now I drink Chardonnay before lunch and hope the mob doesn't ice me before Thursday.
I think he's just bored. He's seen too much. That's why he's always smirking. That's a man who's internally screaming.
Okay, now Brimley.
Brimley? Wilford Brimley. A man who looks like he sleeps in a rocking chair, but is the scariest presence in the film.
He's the firm's head of security and also a war crime in khakis.
He's not watching Mitch. He's hunting him. He doesn't run. He doesn't raise his voice. He just appears in doorways and stares until your spine leaves your body.
He's threatening people while using customer service voice. We'd hate for your wife to get in an accident. Enjoy the shrimp cocktail.
I noticed you've been making a lot of calls to the IRS. Would be a shame if you stopped breathing.
He's the final form of a postmaster general.
I've never seen someone look that terrifying while holding a manila folder.
Let's talk about Cruz. This is one of my favorite Cruz performances because he is trying so hard to stay upright in a movie that is actively trying to kill him with stress.
It's peak, what if this job interview kills me? Energy.
Every time someone speaks to him, he gets visibly wetter.
Yes! He goes from ambitious Harvard grad to panicked tax law Jason Bourne in like 10 minutes. You can see the moment he realizes he's legally doomed and emotionally abandoned and trapped in a real estate Ponzi scheme with the mob.
And his solution? Run faster. Copy things harder. Hide better. Sweat more.
And somehow, it works.
He uses printer paper like other men use knives. He weaponizes compliance. He is the John Wick of document retention.
I'm just going to say it. The firm is weirdly brilliant. It's slow. It's quietly unhinged. It's 2.5 hours of sweat and legal jargon, and it never loses me.
Agreed. It's psychological horror for people who use calendars.
It's prestige paranoia. It's sexy paperwork. It's Gene Hackman in vacation drag, telling you to abandon your morals for a bigger office.
And somehow, every piece fits. The pacing, the casting, the madness of trying to defeat the mob with nothing but binders and fear. It shouldn't work, but it does.
Justice was served, cold, in triplicate.
All right, but real quick. Why did every 90s office have at least one guy who just ate baby carrots at his desk all day like he was watching for predators?
Nope. We're not doing this. We just finished the plot. We are so close to staying on track.
But he's right. There was always a guy, staring at a spreadsheet like it wronged him, just chomping raw carrots like an angry rabbit in Dockers.
Exactly. And not even dipped in anything. Just dry carrots and fury.
This is a legal thriller, not carrot court. We are done with the plot. We are moving on.
No, we need an ad break. Now, this is out of control.
This episode of Rewind or Die is brought to you by Quiet Point Legal Optics. Because sometimes, the best way to resolve a conflict is to erase all traces it ever existed. Quiet Point offers conflict-free conflict resolution with nonverbal consultation options. Our motto? No witnesses, no files, no problem. Use code BRIMLEY10 to receive a complimentary panic room assessment with your first retainer, Quiet Point. Because discretion isn't optional, it's policy.
He just makes everything sound so real.
I think I signed something just by hearing that.
Okay, but what if the carrot guy was in the firm, just chomping while disposing of evidence?
No, nope. We're talking Hackman now. Someone mute Adam. Okay. Yes, Hackman and Cruise carry the movie, but this cast is a deep bench of legendary character actor heat. Like, every single face in this movie is someone who's been in 400 things and never aged.
This cast is a Time Life commercial for 90s thrillers that slap. Call now and receive David Strathairn free with your Tobin Bell cameo.
This entire film is like Law and Order, Mafia Division.
First of all, Holly Hunter. Can we give her a standing ovation for showing up, speaking at 300 words per minute and walking off with every single scene?
She plays Tammy, the secretary slash loose cannon secret agent from Mississippi, and she is iconic. She's got 4 minutes of screen time and somehow feels like she has an arc, a spinoff, and an Emmy nomination.
She comes in hot with a ponytail, a cigarette, an attitude, and just destroys the third act for Stoice.
She could have killed the mob boss and done her taxes in the same scene. She's that efficient.
Next up, David Strathairn as Ray McDear, Mitch's brother, who is in prison for something. It honestly doesn't matter. What matters is he plays the most depressed sibling in cinema history.
He's got the energy of a haunted piano in every scene.
He's like, I've been in prison for years. I hate my life. And also, Mitch is probably going to get us all killed. Want to play cards?
I love Strathairn, but in this movie, he's just vibes and pain. He exists to remind us things could always be worse.
Can we talk about Gary freaking Busey?
Yes, he plays Eddie Lomax, the private investigator with zero chill and maximum off-screen murder potential.
He shows up looking like he's been kicked out of every Applebee's in Tennessee.
He shows up. He's unshaven. He's angry. He's probably holding a gun in his sock. He gives one scene's worth of chaos and then immediately gets murdered.
And honestly, he nailed it. It's the most restrained Busey performance on record, and he's still the wildest man in the movie.
You could tell me all his lines were improvised in a Waffle House booth, and I'd believe you.
Okay, listen to me. Tobin Bell is in this movie.
Yep. Before he was Jigsaw, he was a scary mailroom guy.
He says like two lines and still manages to sound like he's daring you to play a game with your life.
Why does his face look like it already knows how you're going to die? He has the bone structure of dread.
Honestly, this movie could have ended with Tobin Bell trapping Mitch in a file cabinet, and I would have gone, checks out. There's also a whole gallery of incredible that guy actors, the kind of dudes you recognize immediately but could not name under threat of violence.
Yes! Like the FBI agents, who always look like they just transferred from some other federal agency.
They have names like Stan and Rick and Agent Number 2, and they are all brilliant.
It's like the background actor Olympics. Oh, hey, wasn't that guy in The Pelican Brief and 24 and like 9 episodes of ER?
This is That Guy Cinema trademark. A full buffet of dependable mid-90s character actors just crushing 45-second scenes like their SAG-E card depended on it.
The firm is secretly a character actor Avengers movie. They all come in, do a little damage, maybe die, maybe vanish, and leave behind a performance that lives forever in TNT reruns.
No weak links. Not a single miss.
It's actor soup. Hackman's the steak. Brimley's the old scary spoon. Cruise is just screaming into the bowl. But somehow, it works.
All right. I think we've officially shouted about this cast enough.
Wrong. Never enough.
We didn't even mention the janitor who stares too long at Cruise icon.
Let's go back to where it all started. A John Grisham novel, a fax machine, and $40 million in lawyer drama. Let's talk behind the scenes, because the firm wasn't just a hit. It was a full-on cultural event. It was the kickoff to what I can only describe as the John Grisham cinematic universe.
This movie did for legal thrillers what Iron Man did for superheroes.
But with more documents and less charisma.
The firm was directed by Sidney Pollack. Yes, the guy who did Tawootsie, 3 Days of the Condor, Out of Africa, and then woke up one morning and decided, you know what I want to do? A sweaty contract thriller with Tom Cruise.
Legend. And he's in the movie, too. He plays one of the evil law firm partners like, hi, I'm the director. Also, I will destroy your life through legal precedent.
That's how you know it's serious, when the director himself shows up to ruin your day in character.
Sidney Pollack was a prestige filmmaker, but he knew how to make serious adult drama feel slick. He's the king of movies where no one blinks for 2 hours, but you still feel exhausted.
Okay, let's talk Grisham. In the early 90s, this dude could not miss. He was like the Marvel Cinematic Universe, but for dads.
Between 1993 and 1996, Hollywood turned every single book he wrote into a $100 million thriller starring at least one Oscar winner.
Let's list them. The Firm, The Pelican Brief, The Client, A Time to Kill, The Rainmaker, The Chamber, and all of them starred someone whispering dramatically into a phone while under duress.
It was like a genre unto itself. Every movie started with a morally conflicted lawyer and ended with someone running through traffic holding a briefcase.
And it all starts with The Firm. This was the first Grisham book to get the big screen treatment, and Paramount threw everything at it. Cruise, Hackman, Brimley, a jazz piano score. We'll get to that.
Let's talk casting, because I've done some researching, and this movie almost looked very different.
John Grisham originally wanted Charlie Sheen to play Mitch McDear.
What? We were one contract away from this being L.A. Law, Tiger Blood Edition?
Imagine Charlie Sheen sweating through a deposition while drinking cough syrup from a canteen.
And then Jason Patrick turned it down. Jason Patrick? This man read the script and said, nah, I think I'll pass on this future blockbuster with Tom Cruise and Gene Hackman. I'm going to wait for Speed 2. Cruise Control.
Legal thriller with Hackman? Nah, I'll take Haunted Cruise Ship.
Then Tom Cruise comes in. Grisham apparently wasn't thrilled, but Paramount handed Cruise the entire legal system and said, run with it.
Which he literally does. He runs in every scene.
Now here's the wild part. Hackman almost didn't do it.
Unacceptable. This movie without Hackman is like grilled cheese without the cheese. It's just a hot legal sandwich of regret.
He didn't want to be second billed under Cruise. Which, fair, he's Hackman. He doesn't do second place. He's first place in human form.
So they negotiated it, gave him equal billing on some international posters, delayed the movie's release, probably sent him 17 baskets of cheese, whatever it took.
And it was worth it. You can feel Hackman acting like he barely agreed to be there, but he still smokes every scene. The man oozes contractual charisma.
The original ending of the book? Darker. Way more violent. Mitch basically burns everything down and disappears into the wilderness, like lawyer Jason Bourne.
But for the movie, they rewrote it so Mitch outsmarts the firm legally. No guns, no shootouts, just weaponized billing violations.
I love that. Like, imagine rewriting a crime thriller so the climax is you charge $12,000 for parking validation, and now you're going to jail.
They also shot in Memphis and Grand Cayman. And that beach scene? Cruise insisted on doing multiple takes of him sprinting shirtless, because that's what Tom Cruise does.
Honestly, that shot of him running down the beach is like a metaphor for the entire movie. He's sprinting away from the mob, the FBI, his boss, and his own mental health.
I need to bring this up. The score is just one dude on a piano.
Yes, Dave Grusin. One man, one piano, no orchestra, no percussion, just jazzy crime vibes for 2 hours straight.
He's the real MVP. He saw this sweaty legal nightmare and said, "You know what this needs? Smooth lounge keys."
Doo-doo-doo, dead lawyer in a boat, doo-dee-daw, murder in the mailroom.
And you know what? It slaps. The music feels like you're being followed by a very nervous jazz trio. This movie had a legendary director atop of his game, Cruise, a reluctant hackman, chaotic casting options, and a John Grisham goldmine powering it. And somehow, it all came together.
And they filmed it like a horror movie with paperwork.
This isn't just a movie. It's a business casual thriller about surviving corporate hell with nothing but sweat glands and moral ambiguity.
Coming up next, we'll wrap this episode up with our final verdicts on The Firm, what it says about the era, and whether or not Mitch McDeer deserved to survive.
Also, why was this always playing on TNT?
Because it's perfect, Steve. Because every American deserves to see Hackman yell in linen.
It's trivia time, where we take a bunch of fun behind-the-scenes facts and completely derail them with our own screaming commentary.
I don't even care if half of these are true. If I feel them in my soul, they're canon now.
This is the only part of the show where Wikipedia meets performance art.
Gene Hackman read the script and said, "Wait, I gotta kiss someone. No, no, thank you. I promised my wife I wouldn't, and also, I'm Gene Hackman.
I will commit high-level corporate crime on screen. I will verbally seduce an entire firm into moral decay. But lips on lips? Never. That's sacred."
So they rewrote the scene to imply the affair instead, which is somehow way more devious.
Yeah, now it's like he's done this before. Hackman walks out of that hotel room like he's cheated in 8 time zones and hasn't been caught once.
It's big divorce dad energy, and I respect it.
John Grisham hated the movie's ending. He wanted Mitch to go dark mode, burn the firm to the ground, and vanish like a sweaty shadow. But instead, Mitch files a complaint and goes home to Boston.
He wanted Michael Clayton 15 years early, and he got Home Alone, legal edition.
And the music. Grisham despised that smooth, jazzy piano score.
Doo-dee-da, your coworkers are dead. Boo-dap-ba, the FBI is outside. But it's okay, because you're billing hours.
But, like, he's wrong. That score rips. It sounds like a crime is unfolding inside a martini glass. Tom Cruise did all his own running. Like, all of it. This shouldn't be trivia. This should be assumed. Of course, Tom Cruise did his own running. That man sprints through divorce papers.
He runs like a man trying to escape a pyramid scheme and make it to church on time.
He ran so hard in this movie that the pavement filed a restraining order.
And it wasn't just jogging. It was panicked, full-body sprinting, through alleyways, through airports, through spreadsheets.
He ran more miles than his character build, which, honestly, respect.
Holly Hunter stole this movie and an Oscar in the same year. Holly Hunter shows up in The Firm for 4 minutes and steals the entire movie, then goes and wins an Oscar for the piano.
That's like showing up late to a wedding, grabbing the mic, and winning Best Man anyway.
She smokes a cigarette, forges a legal document, shoves a guy, and leaves. That's not acting. That's a war crime performed flawlessly.
I want a whole spin-off movie about her. Just Tammy versus the IRS for 90 minutes. Tom Cruise and Gene Hackman refused to share close-ups. This is my favorite one. Pollock intentionally didn't frame Cruise and Hackman in tight two shots. You never see them sharing the frame in a close-up.
Because they were two powerful alpha males who refused to yield screen space.
Every shot is like a legal custody battle for camera time.
It's all over the shoulder, wide shot, Hackman's looking away, Cruise is behind a fern, it's cinematic Cold War.
And I love that, because it makes every scene feel like a polite duel between gods.
This was the highest-grossing R-rated movie of 1993. The firm made $270 million worldwide. It beat Cliffhanger. It beat Schindler's List. It beat Jurassic Park's R-rated cousin that never existed.
Why? Because America loves seeing Tom Cruise get exploited by paperwork?
Because everyone's uncle saw this movie four times and then bought the VHS at Kmart.
Because the early 90s were starved for legal-based paranoia. This movie was catnip for boomers with a mortgage.
This movie is litigation as entertainment, and it ruled the box office.
There is a law school course based on this movie. There are actual law school classes that use the firm to teach ethics.
Good. They should play it day one. Welcome to Contracts 101. Here's a movie where everyone dies if you ask for a raise.
Midterm essay. Would you snitch to the FBI if Brimley was watching your wife sleep?
Final exam. Run across campus with a box of confidential files while jazz piano plays.
Okay. That's your trivia blitz. This movie had casting drama, musical rebellion, actors refusing eye contact, and Tom Cruise burning calories at a legally concerning rate.
And yet, somehow, a masterpiece.
Made of stress, paper, and defiance.
Okay, wait. Hold on. Adam, we're like, what? An hour 40 into this episode. And you haven't done a game yet. Are you stalling?
Yeah, I've noticed. No quiz, no list, no guessing game. It's getting weirdly wholesome in here.
What if this week we just talked about the movie? You know, reflected, let it breathe.
No, absolutely not. You always have a game. Don't Zen garden me now. I need chaos.
Is this a bit? Are we being punked?
Maybe the real game was just listening to each other. Maybe the real firm was the friends we made along the way.
If you don't start shouting game rules in the next 4 seconds, I'm logging off.
Well, guess what, baby? Welcome to Firm or Fake, a game where I name a law firm, and you tell me if it's from a movie or a real place I found on Google at 2 a.m.
Oh, thank God.
Let's ruin our credibility.
All right, you're going to hear a law firm name. You tell me, firm or fake. Ready?
Emotionally, no, but continue.
Number one, Bendini, Lambert, and Locke.
That's from the firm. Literally this movie, that's the murder firm.
Correct. They specialize in tax evasion and yacht-based assassinations.
Number two, Ketchum and Platt.
That sounds real. Like a firm that sues trampoline parks.
Or handles divorces for billionaires who own pet monkeys.
It's fake. I made it up while eating string cheese.
Unbelievable. That name feels so legal.
Number three, Crane, Poole, and Schmidt.
Oh, that's Boston Legal, the one with Shatner and Spader slow dancing on a balcony.
Accurate. Their closing arguments involve cigars and metaphors.
Correct. That firm would 100% represent Brimley for wrongful Cardigan persecution. Number four, Franklin. Franklin, Franklin, and Franklin.
That sounds fake.
Or it's four cousins in Florida who accidentally started a dynasty.
It's real. They exist. And I respect the commitment to the bit.
That's not a law firm. That's a jam band with briefcases.
Last one, Sneed and Sneed.
Fake. No way.
Real. Too dumb to be fake. It's boomer-proof branding.
It's real. They do corporate litigation and trust falls.
I gotta hand it to you, man. You faked us out hard.
I genuinely thought you were going to quote poetry and end the episode like a TED Talk.
Never doubt me. I always have a game, even when I don't know how it ends.
Like The Firm, perfect full circle.
Except in this case, nobody dies, except maybe our credibility. Hey, you know, was there, like, any fast food tie-in for The Firm?
What? For The Firm? The legal thriller about document fraud and the mafia?
Oh, yeah, definitely. I had the Bendini, Lambert, and Locke Happy Meal. Came with a little briefcase full of fries and a toy fax machine that screams, "No, of course not!"
What if there was a Brimley action figure came with real mustache threat mode? You pull the string on his back and he whispers, "We'd hate to see something happen to your wife."
And the Cruise figure had sweat-powered sprinting action. You wind him up and he just runs in circles around your McNuggets.
They did limited edition NDA napkins. Once you open them, you're legally bound not to tell anyone what was in your burger.
I wanted the Hackman Collector's Cup, but it refused to share shelf space with any Tom Cruise merch.
I swear, if there was any movie less deserving of a fast food promotion, it's this one.
Okay, but imagine a commercial. Black screen. Dramatic voiceover. This summer, get a taste of justice. Boom. The Firm and Fries combo, served with a sealed envelope and a very concerning contract.
Comes with two sides of moral compromise.
And a milkshake you can't legally describe without violating privilege.
Welcome to McJustice. Would you like to supersede that?
Okay. I need to circle back to something. Adam, be honest. Did you pick this movie just so we'd talk about Brimley again?
What? No, absolutely not. I picked it because it's a taut legal thriller and a foundational text of 90s cinema.
You've mentioned Brimley 10 times. You called him the Oatmeal Grim Reaper. You made fan art during the episode.
Okay, wait. Is this the same guy from Cocoon?
Yes. And The Natural and diabetes commercials, but mostly Cocoon. Why?
I've never seen Cocoon, but I assume it's just Brimley yelling at aliens while soaking in a hot tub full of metaphors.
That's honestly not far off.
Like, he's just sitting there yelling, "Get out of my Florida retirement community, you space-based sons of bitches."
You think Cocoon is a science fiction Home Depot commercial?
Look, I know what I know. Brimley plays an elderly Terminator who accidentally absorbs alien life force through chlorine.
That's the exact plot. And then he challenges death to a shuffleboard match.
See? Brimley's whole thing is that he looks like your angry uncle who somehow knows too much about federal law and may have once fought the devil in a Denny's parking lot.
Which brings us back to why we're here. You picked this entire movie just to Brimley bait us.
I refuse to answer that without my attorney present. I refer you to my lawyer, Wilford Brimley.
Wilford Brimley, Esquire, practicing law since the Big Bang.
God help us if we ever do Cocoon for real. Steve's going in blind and loud.
As intended.
Okay, so serious question. What are your thoughts on the John Grisham cinematic universe, like the whole Grishamverse?
Oh, you mean the GCU, the Great Courtroom Universe, the original franchise for dads?
I call it the Beige Extended Universe. It's like the MCU, if everyone wore khakis and cried about paperwork.
It's wild. Like, every single movie is just someone whispering legal exposition in a parking garage while a jazz score says, "You're in danger, but quietly."
And they're all named, like, incredibly tense deli sandwiches. The Client, The Firm, The Pelican Brief, The Rainmaker, The Chamber, The Gingerbread Deposition. Okay, I made that one up, but you believed it.
Each movie is just a different flavor of lawsuit panic. The Client is kid in danger panic. The Firm is briefcase panic. The Rainmaker is insurance panic.
And every single one has a southern accent, a corrupt old man, and one young lawyer sweating his soul out.
They all have one scene where someone yells at a judge, slams a folder shut, and cries in a stairwell. And if that doesn't happen, guess what? It's not a Grisham movie.
I want the Grisham Avengers. Bring all the lawyers together. Cruise, Damon, Roberts, McConaughey. Put them in one courtroom. Have Hackman's ghost be the judge.
You joke, but I would watch the hell out of the summons, a Grisham crossover event.
Yes. The Grisham Civil War. Team Firm, Mitch McDear. Team Pelican, Denzel and Julia. Team Rainmaker, Baby Matt Damon and Danny DeVito with a briefcase full of illegal documents and old muffins. That's my favorite team.
And the client kid is now grown up and bitter. He sues everyone.
Every movie ends the same way. Someone walks out of a courthouse slowly while jazz piano plays, and no one is emotionally okay.
Justice, but make it trauma.
John Grisham's paralegal initiative drops 2025.
Okay, we need to talk about it. Gene Hackman, 90s Gene Hackman. That man wasn't just in movies, he was movies.
Yes, this man didn't miss. He was on a run so hot you could cook a pot roast on his IMDb.
Gene Hackman in the 90s is why your dad stopped reading.
He did The Firm in 93. But that was just the tip of the Hackberg. You also had Crimson Tide, The Birdcage, Enemy of the State, Get Shorty, The Quick and the Dead, Absolute Power, Wyatt Earp, Narrow Margin, Unforgiven. Okay, fine, that's 92, but it still counts because he's furious in it. And like five movies where he just plays an angry government official wearing khakis.
That man woke up angry in a windbreaker and went to set every single day.
He's either the president, a general, a senator, a lawyer, or a very intimidating guy who owns a boat and makes you regret everything.
And the thing is, all those movies played on TNT, all of them.
You could not flip channels in the 2000s without seeing Gene Hackman yelling in a Situation Room.
Gene Hackman built the Turner Broadcasting empire by hand with dad dramas.
He is personally responsible for 47% of all TNT weekday afternoon programming between 1996 and 2008.
Gene Hackman is the reason you know what the word jurisdiction means.
Every time he said the words, "I gave you an order," a dad in Ohio nodded in approval and checked the grill.
It wasn't just a career, it was a lifestyle. He didn't act, he commanded, he didn't deliver lines, he verbally dismantled people in corduroy slacks.
He had resting disappointed coach face. The energy of you had potential, son, but you threw it away, and America ate it up.
He was boomer gravitas personified, like if a leather belt and a stern lecture were a man.
And what makes it beautiful is that Hackman wasn't trying to be iconic. He was just clocking in, doing the work, being grumpy for justice.
You know how you and your friends talk about Keanu or Tom Cruise or Liam Neeson's action dad phase? Our dads were like, yeah, that's cool. But have you seen Gene Hackman tear a Navy officer in half with words?
If Clint Eastwood is Old Testament judgment, then Hackman is post-divorce custody battle law.
And honestly, we need to bring this energy back. Hackman Corps. Thrillers for people who still write checks at the grocery store.
Gene Hackman walked so Yellowstone could run.
And if TNT ever collapses, they better bury it with a DVD copy of Crimson Tide and a bag of sunflower seeds.
All right, so final thoughts on The Firm. I actually think it holds up really well. It's tense, it's surprisingly grounded. And even though it's absolutely bonkers on paper, lawyer joins murder firm, defeats the mob with spreadsheets. It's directed with so much restraint that you actually believe it. And that's Sidney Pollack.
Wow. Jeff's in his Letterboxd era.
Please rate and subscribe to his Legal Thrillers and Feels vlog.
No, seriously, like this movie could have been way louder, but Pollack directs it like it's an adult drama about consequences. Even when there's murder on a boat, it's still classy. It's controlled. He makes paperwork look cinematic.
And you know that's a true skill, because most movies, if you spend 40 minutes watching someone photocopy a binder, you'd walk into the sea. But this, I was locked in.
Have either of you ever seen any other Sidney Pollack movies, like outside this one?
Yeah. I love that one where Robert Redford seduces the CIA using jazz.
That's actually pretty close. Are you talking about 3 Days of the Condor?
Maybe.
I've seen Tootsie. That's him, right?
Yes, that's actually him. Wow.
I only remember Dustin Hoffman in drag and, like, everyone being uncomfortable.
I assumed Sidney Pollack only made movies that dads would rent on accident.
Dude, he produced The Talented Mr. Ripley also. I mean, he was the king of movies that start with soft jazz and end with emotional devastation.
And he directed Out of Africa, like Prestige, Prestige, won Oscars. It's basically the opposite of The Firm. There's no fax machines in Out of Africa.
Should have been. Meryl Streep sends a fax from the Serengeti, Oscar locked.
I'm telling you, Pollack's whole thing was vibes and guilt. Everyone in his movies is in love, in trouble, or under surveillance. Sometimes all three.
He was grown-up cinema before that became a marketing term. You put on a Sidney Pollack movie, and suddenly you're drinking wine, reading court transcripts, and making hard decisions.
That's why The Firm works. You need that exact kind of director to make copy machine espionage feel like a Shakespearean betrayal.
The Firm is like if someone made a horror movie about working overtime, and Sidney Pollack directed it like a soft-spoken panic attack. I respect that.
Same. I think it's underrated. And honestly, I'm actually glad we covered it. Not just for the Brimley memes, not just for the Hackman heat, but because it's a perfect example of how tight adult thrillers used to rule the box office.
And they all came with one guy yelling, "I didn't break the law," while the soundtrack whispers, "But maybe you did."
And if nothing else, it gave us sweaty cruise.
Which is always the right cruise. All right, that's The Firm. Next week, we are officially diving into Crimson Tide, the submarine thriller where Hackman goes full Hackman and Denzel has to contain him like a nuclear threat.
Oh, I'm ready. Hackman in a tight hallway yelling about protocol while Denzel stares him down in a sweat-drenched power play. It's 12 Angry Men in a Tube.
Also known as Gene Hackman's I Will Out-Act You in This Closet Tour.
After that, we're narrowing down what Hackman movie to do next. We're keeping it focused. Tight run. 3 or 4 picks, max.
No, I want to do Enemy of the State. Hackman in a hoodie screaming about surveillance while Will Smith jumps through grocery stores.
I vote The Birdcage. Hackman in full conservative meltdown mode, surrounded by drag queens and Robin Williams' chaotic gay energy.
I also submit The Quick and the Dead. It's Hackman as a gunslinging mayor with too much power and not enough mustache control.
This is not a process. This is verbal anarchy.
Get Shorty. He's a Hollywood executive with no patience and a pocket full of threats.
What about Heist? David Mamet dialogue, Hackman. Doing crime math, Delroy Lindo standing nearby looking disappointed.
You are just shouting titles now. We need structure, a clear Hackman arc.
Of course, yeah. Let's build a hack map. A genealogy, if you will.
You made that up just now and it still works?
Jeff.
Also, if you've been listening to Rewind or Die Shorts, we're doing those every Thursday now. Short form chaos, looser, dumber, a place where we talk about what we're watching, and fast food regrets with no format whatsoever.
The last one covered Steve's oil change breakdown, my Arby's spiral, and Jeff explaining why he once frisbee golfed for 22 years. I don't know. I think we record those out of order, like a stream of consciousness chaos.
Next one might just be us trying to remember 40 forgotten DVD menu screens from our childhood.
And maybe we'll actually recommend a movie, but don't get your hopes up.
All right. We'll be back next week with Crimson Tide, a movie where nuclear war is less tense than who gets to yell louder in a hallway.
Until then, salute Hackman. He built TNT with anger and gravitas.
And remember, if your law firm gives you a BMW, it's already too late.
We're still doing The Replacements last, though. That's non-negotiable.
You are derailing my entire calendar.
It's what Gene would want.
All right. We got to land this, folks. That's it for this week's episode of Rewind or Die. We talked sweaty legal thrillers, dad movie royalty, facts-based espionage, and the terrifying power of Wilford Brimley's gaze.
And next week, submarines, missiles, yelling, Hackman and Denzel in Crimson Tide, a movie so tense you'll taste steel.
Until then, go find a briefcase, copy something illegally, and question your firm's onboarding process.
And remember, not every job perk is worth it, especially if Brimley comes with it.
Don't sign anything you can't outrun.
And if a jazz piano starts playing, run.
We'll see you next time on Rewind or Die.
Brimley's still out there.
Watching, faxing, judging.
Just end the episode. End it.
All right. If you somehow survived all of that, make sure you like, subscribe, scream into the algorithm, whatever works. New episodes drop every Monday. And we've got Rewind or Die shorts coming every Thursday. So you're getting double doses of this chaos every week. Follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and yes, even X. We are everywhere. Your aunt shares minion memes and your ex posts cryptic quotes about loyalty. Thanks for listening. We'll see you Thursday. Do not miss it.
You're still here? It's over. Go home. Go.
Producer Steve hopes you have enjoyed this program.